Namaste and welcome. It's good to see everyone here today. And we'll begin with the satsang bowl and see what we have today. Can you talk about anger? Oh, do I have to? Can't we all just get along? No. Lately, I have to share my desk with another person at work, and she agitates me beyond reason. What to do? Our energies are so opposite. Everything about her bugs me. I'm civil. I tried talking things out. We just can't stand each other. Ooh. One of life's little... The hard lessons, huh? We got into the hard ones already? Ooh. Well, you could either try, see if there's somebody else you could share a desk with at work. And if that's not option, then you just got to realize that her stuff is her stuff. You know, you're not going to change her. It's not going to, you know, it may be like that for the rest of the time that you're there. So you got to learn to kind of go with the flow and just recognize that her stuff is her stuff. She has a right to her whatever it is that she's doing. But you also have a right not to, you know, gravitate to it.
Is this a test because I'm attached to my space and my desk and I hate to see her parked there when I come in? She even has a butt bigger than mine, which is a difficult accomplishment. I don't know. Should I just...
This is a test. It's a test if you think it's a test. If you have the mentality that this is a test, it's going to be a test. See if you can kind of take it out of the realm of being a test, if you can. See that it's okay, it's just something that happens, and okay, this is going to eventually change. It is a transient situation. And it gives you a chance to just kind of look at things and see that you don't have to get drawn in by somebody else's stuff. Okay. Yeah. Just kind of try to maintain your own center and let them do what they're going to do. Yeah. Not always easy, but yeah. Yeah. Some of the realities of the world are not fun. You know, what can we say? It's like, you know, the same thing on the net. I can give everything from the heart, absolutely, but there will be people that are judging it and you're arrogant or it's this or it's that or, you know, and you have no control over how they're going to view it. We can only do what we can do and just, you know, be true to that, be transparent in our own lives and our own selves. And the world is going to relate or react whatever according to their own particulars. Okay. How can I avoid picking up other people's hurts, illnesses, and emotions? I'm certainly not trying to do this. By recognizing when you are, letting it go? Just, you know, kind of blow it out and go, this isn't mine. Recognizing that it's not your stuff. And then don't keep entertaining it. Okay. Then just try to go back into meditation and kind of let it fall away. I think one of the most difficult times is just recognizing if it's yours or if it's not your stuff, you know, in the beginning. Because you'll be going along and everything will seem fine and you'll pass somebody, get around them, and all of a sudden their energy, you start picking it up and it's your whole thing can shift. So just look at it and question it. Well, why am I entertaining this and going with this shift? So yeah, just kind of try to let go of it. What is this existing thing? Does nothing exist that is not eternal? To me, it does for a while at least. Even only like an illusory fabrication, it seems real here and now. So complete non-existence seems somewhat unlikely. Well, yeah, as long as you're in the mind duality, what's here is going to be absolutely real to you. And maybe you can have a philosophy of something other than this. Okay. But eventually, when you step or dissolve into the absolute, then only the absolute will seem to have reality, and then this world will seem to be nothing more than a dream state. And then you'll understand what is meant by that. And when we say that, the absolute is the only thing that has reality, we say that because it's unchanging. Doesn't mean that this world doesn't have a sense of reality to it. It does, but it's transient. It's always in flux. It's always changing. It's not stable. The only thing you can count on in this world is change. Okay. So it's just all the perceptual where you're at in the consciousness as to how you view what's reality and what's not reality. Okay. So we have a very short satsang today. That was it for the questions. But I thought what I might do today is read an article from one of the Buddhist magazines. There were really some good articles in two of the Buddhist magazines this month. So we'll take a quick break so I can go in and find where they're at. I know one of them's in the car. The other one, I don't know where it's at the moment, but we'll take a quick break. Short satsang days, maybe we'll just do an article out of these because they are great. So we're going to do the middle way. Soyen Shaku's classic sermon on finding the balance between discipline and intuition. One day, Hongzhen, the fifth patriarch of the Dana sect in China, made an announcement to his disciples. And I'm sure many of you have heard this story before, but it's always a wonderful story. Saying that whoever was capable of giving a satisfactory proof of his thorough comprehension of Buddhism would succeed him in religious authority. The result was the following two stanzas, the first by one of his learned disciples and the second by his humble rice pounder, who was, however, awarded the prize. Now, I'll give you a little background for those that have not heard the story before. This guy went to the Buddhist place and he wanted to become enlightened. And so the head of the monastery said, well, do you want to become enlightened or do you want to really know the Dharma and all the practices and all? He says, no, I want enlightenment. He goes, well, I tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go back in the kitchen and just take care of the rice and don't come out again until I call for you. Well, he was there for 12 years. No instruction, nothing. Just every day cleaning the rice, pounding the rice, cleaning the rice, pounding the rice. That was his whole function. Where all the other monks were doing the meditation and they're talking and they're debating and they're doing, you know, all of these other things. So when it came time, we'll see who had the best understanding. The learned monk says, the body is the holy Bodhi tree. The mind is like a mirror shining bright. Exert yourself to keep them always clean and never let the dust accumulate. And the rice pounder said, no holy tree exists as Bodhi known. No mirror shining bright is standing here. Since there is nothing from the very first, where can the dust itself accumulate? So the one was all about the practices. And the other was, had gotten the knowledge of really what it is. The two stanzas are suited to illustrate that to obtain a comprehensive view of truth, it is not enough to know only one side of the shield, but we must turn it around and see the reverse, as one is complementary to the other. Judging superficially, the two stanzas appear to be directly contradicting each other, for while one advocates the strenuous life, the other seems to be tending towards nihilism and libertism. In my opinion, however, Buddhism would be incomprehensible if these two apparently antagonizing views were not synthesized and harmonized and blended. Now, I don't see it that way at all, that it's two antagonistic views whatsoever. But we'll go on to see what he says. These two stanzas are the two wings of a bird or the two wheels of a cart, or perhaps more exactly, one is like the eye and the other the legs. With the eye we can see, but we cannot move, as we have no legs. With the legs we are able to move, but we are blind. As we are without sight, from the standpoint of absolute truth, there is no such thing as mind or matter or even God or universe. But if we confine ourselves to this view and become blind to the other side, which says that the many exist, that the world actually is, we are like the man who has no legs. We are unable to move. We cannot carry ourselves. We are helpless. We cannot live our daily life. Philosophical insight may be far-reaching enough, but it is the contentless. It lacks the material on which to work. Therefore, we must look at the other side and see how our practical life is to be regulated. We must see how our legs are fixed, whether they are strong enough to take us where the eye is directing. Again, we must not forget that practical discipline alone does not lead us to the final abode of enlightenment. It's very excellent not to neglect the cleaning of the mirror, the purifying of the mind, which is likely all the time to collect the dust of passion on it. But if we fail to see that a mere conventional superficial purification is very much like groping in the dark, without the knowledge of the import of existence, our spiritual horizon will draw itself within narrow limits like a snail retiring within the shell, and we may lose our original, intrinsic, spontaneous freedom and tranquility, which belong to the mind by its own construction. We must put ourselves under an unnecessary yoke, moving only within a prescribed circle. In other words, we may lose simplicity, naturalness, ease of movement in our thinking and doings. In what follows, I will consider the teaching of Buddhism as stated in the two stanzas harmoniously viewed. The first stanza begins with the line, "The body is the holy Bodhi tree." In this, our body is compared to the sacredness of the Bodhi tree, under which the founder of Buddhism attained his spiritual enlightenment and laid down the foundation of his system. The body, however evanescent in its character, must be considered holy even as the holy tree, and all the necessary care should be taken to keep it the worthy vessel in which the spirit is lodged. There are many fanatic believers in asceticism and self-mortification, thinking that this material existence is the root of evil, and therefore, the more it is tortured, the purer and holier will grow the spirit. The flesh is in its very nature antagonistic to the spirit. They cannot thrive in harmonious relation with each other. The stronger the flesh, the weaker the spirit, and vice versa. The line, "the body is the holy Bodhi tree," is directed against those who hold this kind of view. That is to say, Buddhism does not espouse any ascetic practice, nor does it hold a doctrine tending to a dualistic conception of existence, which makes the flesh the source of evil and the spirit the foundation of everything good. The body as a material phenomena has its limitations, as a living organism has its impulses, desires, passions, and modes, and there is nothing evil or wicked in it. It is thirsty and must drink. It is hungry and must be fed. Exposure to cold affects its well-being, and it must be clothed. Too much strenuosity exhausts its system, and it must rest. All these things are inherent in it, and unless we demand that the tree grow as the fish, as a Japanese saying goes, it is altogether irrational to wish our bodily existence to be free from all its constitutional wants. Therefore, Buddhism teaches us not to curb them and torture the body, but to regulate them and prevent their going to self-destruction through wantonness. The second line reads, "The mind is like a mirror shining bright." This may suggest, when contrasted with the first line, a dualistic conception of our existence, making mind independent of body. But I'm not going to enter into this complicated problem, the problem of mind and body, whether they are one or separate. For convenience's sake, I take the mind as subjective aspect of the body, and body is the objective aspect of the mind. To speak more popularly, the mind is the inner side of the body, and the body is the outer case of the mind. They both make up one solid reality. Within it is felt as consciousness, and without it is perceived as body. Now this body is sacred as the Bodhi tree, and every care has to be taken for its well-being. So with the mind, it must be made to retain its original purity through moral discipline. The mind, as is it first came from the hands of God, was pure, simple, illuminating as a mirror. But in its constant contact with the world of sense, it has become liable to be carried away by its impressions and impulses without ever reminding itself of its original purity. What comes from outside does not, of course, defile the mind. But when the latter loses its own control and gives way to sensuality, the dust begins to accumulate on it. When its transparency is thus gone, the mind becomes a plaything of all chance, impulses, and haphazard impressions, like a river ark drifting in the ocean and being tossed up and down by the capricious waves. Buddhism calls such a one ignorant and wanting in the Bodhi or wisdom. It is therefore admonishing us to reflect within ourselves constantly, not to give a free rein to the sensual, selfish, unenlightened passions. The reason why Buddhism has so many moral precepts and monastic rules to regulate the lives of the lay disciples and monks will now be understood. They are all intended for the purification of the mind and the regulation of bodily desires. They're meant to ward off the evil influences that disturb serenity of mind and simplicity of heart, in order that our divine, natural, residing within us, the divine nature residing within us, may fulfill its own significance and be free in its own operations. Buddhism does not desire to impede in any way our rational activities, but simply to check the progress of desires, selfish impulses, and unenlightened motives. So far, we have dealt with the ethical and practical phase of Buddhism as enunciated in the first stanza. Now we must go around and see what is the other side of Buddhism, which constitutes the philosophical foundation of the system. It's not enough for us. It is not worthy of the name of a human being merely to live and not to endeavor to unravel the mysteries of life. As a rational conscious being, we must look into the reason of things. We must know the why of existence. To live even as a saint is not quite gratifying to the intellectual cravings of the human mind. Of course, every religion must find its culmination in our practical life and not in our abstract speculation. Yet we must seek a philosophical basis of conduct. And Buddhism finds this in the second stanza cited at the beginning of this discourse. At first blush, the stanza seems to smack not a little of nihilism, as it apparently denies the existence of individuality. But those who stop short at this negative interpretation of it are not likely to grasp the deep significance of Buddhism. For Buddhism teaches in this stanza that the existence of the highest reality that transcends the duality of body and mind, as well as the limitations of time and space. Though this highest reality is the source of life, the ultimate reason of existence and the norm of things multifarious and multitudinous has nothing particular in it. It cannot be designated by any determinative terms. It refuses to be expressed in the phraseology we use in our common parlance. And why? For it is an absolute unity, and there is nothing individual, particular, dualistic, or conditional. It's a great mistake, an intellectual weakness, to suppose that there is such a thing as a personal God or an immortal soul that stands like a bright and shining that is susceptible to contamination or corruption. For practical purposes, we may provisionally admit the existence of an entity that some call God and that is independent of this world. We may again admit the existence of the soul that is the master of this material phenomena called body. But to understand these things as actually existing the way our short-sighted intellect conceives them is a fatal mistake. We must first directly comprehend the spiritual reason of things, and then let us, with this insight, look upon things as they are about us. It would be madness to deny the reality of the phenomenal world. But in the midst of these realities, the enlightened see the non-reality. There towers a huge mountain. Here lies a boundless ocean. Birds are singing. Trees are growing. And I sit here looking over the verdant meadow. Yet in spite of all of these, no, indeed by reason of these, I believe in the nothingness of existence. In the non-reality of realities and in the absolute oneness of all things. And it is thereby that I gain my peace of mind and realize the sense of perfect freedom in my everyday life. All these moral laws and religious regulations, which I at first found unreasonably fettering my free activity, are now blessings. For I am no more than those laws and rules themselves. I have become the master of them. I am the maker of all the moral laws, and my existence consists in the execution of them. I say this and then ask you, does God feel himself hampered in his activity when he has so many laws of nature to observe? Does he, for instance, complain of the law of gravity when he wants an apple to drop on the ground? Is he not perfectly free in following the laws of nature? And are we not made in his image? I see then no obstacles, no hampering, no discordant jarring in my following the laws of my being. And hereby we go back to the first stanza of moral discipline. We find now the middle course of truth, a complete harmonization of discipline and naturalness. At first, we had a feeling of compulsion and restraint. But now at the mastery of the second stanza, we have a philosophical intuition and feel perfectly at ease. We move as we will, yet we do not transgress. Our conduct, when our spiritual enlightenment reaches this stage, is in complete accord with the reason of heaven and earth, for we are now identified with it. From the start, our religious discipline has been to attain this ease, this freedom, this simplicity, this spirituality, and we have at last reached the goal and are at rest. The bird has acquired two strong wings. The cart is supplied with a pair of running wheels, and we have the eyes that see and the legs that walk. There is nothing now in this life that will be possibly cause vexation of spirit or the gnashing of teeth and the palpation of the heart. So such is the path that goes full circle. In the end, it's just sattvic flow. You'll be in harmony with what the universe is, and you don't see any kind of a discordant thing. It's two sides of the same coin. Whether it's the unchanging of absolute or the motion of Shakti. And when you come to the end, then you have the balance, that zero-point balance. It's neither one nor the other. Okay. So namaste, and thank you for coming. We'll take a quick break, and we'll have meditation.